session number 17743, Reel 3.
Mr. Curtis, Reel 3.
Right. I've forgotten.
You were just saying about a neighbour.
Yeah, I've forgotten. His daughter lived up here, just behind us. And he was a doctor. And he was originally with the County of Warwick Squadron at Castle Bromwich, just when the war broke out. But he was then on a medical officer on one of the stations at Bomber Command. And he said to me one day here, we were having a drop of sherry on a Sunday morning, and he said, quite extraordinary, he said, the morale was, he said, I don't know how people just went on. And the morale was not affected. You had a few people went LMF, which is lack of moral fibre, but very, very few indeed. And the morale was quite extraordinary. You sort of, well, something like that happened and you had a pint of beer, went to bed and that was it.
What accounts for the high morale?
I don't really know. Everybody was sort of... everybody had sort of... I think they all felt they'd got a job to do and that was it. And you've got to get on with it. And the morale was really quite extraordinary.
We now come on to a period, July, August, September period, in which you were doing a lot of raids on Germany. Do any of them stick out in your mind?
No. No, that was on... This is on Lanx. No. No. There was one raid that we did, which was quite a long one, and we went to Nuremberg. And that was a bit dodgy because you had to dodge between places like Karlsruhe and Mainz and so on, which was, they were very heavily defended. And we did it okay, and we got back.
That raid appears to be the 28th of August, 1942, according to your logbook.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know without looking at it.
And you were still using G?
Yes, but we were being jammed by then, I think. But in any case, G wouldn't go in as far as, wouldn't extend to Nuremberg. It would only go into the areas like Cologne and Duisburg, Essen and so on, the Ruhr, and north of there.
What effect on your television screen markings would be shown by the jamming?
Well, you just couldn't see the pulses. Couldn't get any pulses, or they were very indistinct.
Was it covered with interference?
Mm. 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 It's very difficult to remember, but you just couldn't pick up the pulses at the extreme ranges. We got an eastern chain, and we got a southern chain, and it was better going down on the southern chain into France, and we went to Italy, of course. You couldn't get it down there, but it put you okay, sort of well down into France. There didn't seem to be the interference on the southern chain that there was on the eastern chain.
In fact, mentioning Italy, the 22nd of October 1942, you put operation on Genoa, three engines, wizard trip, very successful raid.
Yes. That, I think you'll see, was with Wing Commander Smales.
Yes.
Who was our squadron commander. What happened with my crew, you'll see I did about three or four at the end there, one with Smales and several with a chap named Mitchell. I had been sent off to RAF Manby on a bombing leaders course. I think it was about 3 weeks, either fortnight or 3 weeks. And I was the, whatever flight I was in, A flight, I was the flight bombing leader, as well as doing my job as a navigator. And so my crew, I got out of, a bit out of phase with them. So I, at the end, I'd got about 4 trips or 5 trips to do to make up my number. And we did this, there was this raid on Genoa, and I went with the wing commander. What happened, when we got to Reading on the way out, we lost an engine. And Wing Commander Smale said, oh, well, we'll go over into France. We'd got a, if you weren't going to bomb your primary target, we got an alternative which was called SEMO or MOPA. Self-evident military objective or military objective previously attacked. And he said, oh, well, we'll go over to France and bomb somewhere there. You know, I said, well, I'm sorry, we can't. He said, why not? I said, it's absolutely covered in cloud. And in the occupied territories, you couldn't just drop anywhere indiscriminately. You had to have a target to attack. And I said, well, look, let's sort this. Give me a few minutes, and I got the flight engineer. We worked out what petrol we'd got and how we could do it. And I said to Wing Commander Smales, I said, you may think I'm stupid, but I think we could make it. He said, to Genoa. And I said, yes, I think we could. Right, he said, we'll go. And we went from Reading, or just south of Reading, the English coast, say, to Genoa and back on 3 engines. Of course, we were about half an hour, 40 minutes late of the main attack. So when we got there, I think the ITIs had gone to bed, because at first there was no flak, no searchlights, no nothing. So I remember going out to sea and coming in, and where you got water and land, it was quite good at night to distinguish. This is why Hamburg got pasted. It was quite good at night to distinguish features. And we attacked the docks at Genoa, coming in from the sea. And actually, the bomb aimer was doing the run. And I actually sketched the very roughly, of course, the dock area and where the fires were burning in the docks, and that was handed in when we got back. And I remember old Smales; he was a wonderful bloke. I think it was we got Johnny Johnson with us, who was the squadron gunnery leader, and he was later the gunnery leader at Pathfinder Group. Oh, Johnny, he was another good guy. And he, there was a fighter, or Smales said, Johnny or one of the gunners said that, and said, I think there's a fighter on our tail or coming in to attack. And John, old Smith said, oh, don't worry me about it, just shoot it down. He was a lovely bloke. And I saw him the year before last up at Waddington. That's the first time I'd seen him since then.
I think 2 days later, 24th of October, you did a daylight raid on Milan.
That's right.
And you were members of that one?
Yes. We went, I'm almost sure that was a Saturday. That was with Mitchell, I think.
Yes.
Mitch was a Rhodesian who'd been very badly burned. He crashed in a Hampden at Upper Hayford, and he'd been badly burned, and then he'd come onto the Lank. And we took off. We flew down to the south coast. We went across the channel, very low down, 100 feet or so. And we crossed the French coast just about calm. And the whole of the north of France was covered in cloud. So we climbed into cloud and we flew down using G in the cloud. We flew down until we got out over what was then Vichy France, which wasn't occupied. And then we went on from there in daylight. We climbed up over the Alps, dropped down onto Milan, and we bombed Milan about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, something like that. Broad daylight, and then we came out back northwest up to the Alps over, and we flew home in the dark. A trip to down there took the best part of 10 hours. In fact, I think 10 and a quarter hours one of them was. So it was a fairly long thing. It was, as far as I can remember, it was quite a useful raid, because in daylight, of course, you could see the town, and don't know whether the Italians certainly weren't as their opposition was nothing like the Germans, nothing like the Germans.
Now, how did you come to leave the 44 Squadron?
Well, I'd finished my tour. I'd done my 30 raids. when I started, the tour was 200 hours, but then they changed it to raids. And the tour was 30 raids. And I had done 5 on Hamdens, so I suppose, strictly speaking, I could have finished it with 25 on 44, but I did, in fact, 30. I did 30 on length.
That was in November 42. Okay. Then I think you became an instructor.
Yes. And it was... that was... November 42, I got my first DFC. That's right.
Was it for your general work or for something specific?
Well, it was the general work allied to this raid on... which I did with the wing commander. Because he got the DSO.
What condition were you in by the time you finished the tour?
Oh, I was all right. I remember that we were going. Of course, you always got a fortnight's leave after you finished the tour. And I was going home, but they held me back a day or two because some VIP was going to come to inspect us. Because we'd also done some daylights in France, which I wasn't on, Le Creuseau, and so on. I wasn't on those. and it turned out to be the king. And he came and inspected us, and the other squadron at Waddington, which was 9 Squadron. I went home after that, and I did my 14, had my 14 days leave, and came back, and then they posted me to Chipping Warden, which was the OTU where I went as a navigation instructor.
How did you like doing that?
I didn't.
Why not?
Oh, it wasn't. I preferred to be on operations and not training.
For what reason?
I don't know. I suppose it was partly my fault that I didn't like some of the people that were that I was subordinate to. In that some of them had never actually been on operations.
Did you hold it against them because they hadn't been on operations?
No, but what I objected to was when they were told me off for not instructing properly. or according to the book, let's put it that way. I was not according to the manual.
Were they accusing you of taking shortcuts?
Yes, and I tried to teach people what I could, to use the experience that I had gained, so that they wouldn't have the sort of difficulties that we'd found when we started on operations, and. They wanted done absolutely according to the book, laid down.
What type of things did they object to specifically that you were telling the students?
Well, first of all, on that station, I was the only one that knew anything about G, so they made me the G instructor. There was a G manual, of course. And I used that, by and large, as the guide, but I also used some of my experiences. And they insisted that I used the manual absolutely straight down. I hadn't to deviate, so. I was not happy, let's put it that way. I was not happy on that station.
So how did you get back to operations?
I don't know to this day. We had the chief instructor, there was a CO, chief instructor, and he had got an adjutant, and I was called into the adjutant's office one day and said, there's a posting come through for you to 1655 OTU. Oh, incidentally, yes, before that, a chap who'd been on 44, Jimmy Evans, was the 5-group navigation leader, and he rang me up one day and said, I got a job for you, Ron, station navigation officer at one of the 5-group places. And I said, oh, wonderful. Wonderful. He said, well, you'll have to come up and see the group commander and so on. I said, that's great. He sent an aircraft down for me. And the people at Chipping Warden forbade me to go. They actually put me under close arrest so that I couldn't leave the station. And I thought that was a I didn't like it at all. And so when this thing came through to a 1655 mosquito unit, mosquito training unit, which I knew was the Pathfinders, I jumped for joy. the adjutant said to me, well, we shall have to see if we can release you. So I said, okay, fair enough. But of course, Bennett and the man who recruited a lot of air crew for the Pathfinder Force, Mahadi, Group Captain Mahadi, they could get anybody from anywhere. And they couldn't stop me. So I went to 1655 at Mara, which was, wonderful.
Why was it so wonderful?
Well, to get out of this training attitude and to get back onto operations where I felt I was doing something far more useful than I was on training.
Was it there that you were introduced to the mosquito?
Yes, that was when I was up at Marham.
What, can you tell me about how you reacted to the mosquito?
Oh, it was a marvellous aeroplane. Absolutely wonderful. And of course, going on to this oboe stuff, had it not been for the mosquito, we should never have had the ability to mark the targets we did, unless it had been, if we hadn't had the mosquito, because we had to have the height. And the oboe, mosquito, of course, got 28,000-30,000 feet, which there was no other aircraft at that time could reach that height at all. And of course it was fairly fast, which was another good thing, because when we got onto mosquitoes, we didn't have any armament at all, absolutely unarmed. And that was the whole of the time, right through to the end of the war, we didn't have any guns whatsoever on those aircraft. It was very satisfying to be chosen to go on to Pathfinder. As far as I was concerned, I felt I was quite honoured to have been chosen to do that.
What about the position of the navigator and comfort in a mosquito?
Well, they were pretty cramped. Pretty cramped. But we managed, because we got all our oboe equipment in the nose. We didn't have a bomb sight or anything like that. We did everything on sound. It was all done on audio. And we got a little board for doing my navigation on my knees and so on. There wasn't a lot of room, but we managed. We managed okay. And I could get down and tune the oboe equipment in and so on and get the signals through.
Can you tell me about your first introduction to oboe?
Well, we did some... Do you know what a link trainer is? Like a simulator. Well, we did some exercises on the ground where we got a link trainer set up, and we could do actually, we could simulate a raid, say, to Essen and back, and do a run, because you had to, perhaps it'd be easier if the pilot had to fly down a beam, and the beam was very narrow. I think I'm right in saying it was about 51 feet, and it didn't diverge. It was constant the whole way down, and the pilot got dots and dashes and an equi-signal. When he was at steady note, he was in the middle of the beam. And that's when he got a hold. And the navigator got various position signals telling him how far from the target he was. A's, B's, C's and D's and so on. And we did all this sitting as we might be here. In a room with... a link trainer set up and so on, which was, and this fellow Harry Scott that I mentioned earlier up in
Scotland,
Portsoy, he was the man who did the actual plotting, which we plotted, and he told us how far out we were and all this sort of thing. He was very, very good. And then, having got used to that sort of system, We then did some exercises over this country. Whereby we took off and we got our route and our run, and quite often we bombed on, well, I say we bombed, we used to go to places like
don't worry.
No, on the north coast of Wales anyway, where they'd got a sort of an infrared thing, and you could use that as a means of sort of bombing so that we get our signals. And what happened was this. To operate on this OBO system, you really needed to be settled down on the beam for about 10 minutes. Or at least you got 10 minutes. And I got an A at 10 minutes, and a B at 8, a C at 6, a D at 3, and then approximately 2.25 minutes after I got the D, I would get the release signal, which was 5 dots, high-speed dots, and a dash. And on silence, I pressed. And that was... We were controlled by ground stations in this country, you see. And my wife was one of the radar operators on the ground. This is all very clever stuff. And John Hooper, who you met, John is the only surviving member now of the original team that devised this system. And it was the... Well, Bomber Harris himself said at last he had the means of bombing the Ruhr, bombing the major industrial areas of Germany.
What were the problems of using OBO as far as you were concerned?
Initially, it was the sort of consistency of the signals. But as the experience developed with from the technical side, the reliability became much more than it was in the early days, and it was, well, I think Bomber Command wouldn't have achieved anything like its results without OBO. There's no question about that at all. Because the other radar system which was introduced, which is on Lancasters, on the heavy bombers anyway, we couldn't do it, was H2S, which I never saw. And that was a system whereby you got the transmitter and the receiver in the aircraft, and you sent out a pulse or pulses, and you got a reflection back from the ground, and on the screen you saw the outline of the land over which you were flying. And of course that was very good where, as I said earlier, where you got water and land sort of down the River Rhine on the, or going into Hamburg off the North Sea there and so on. The thing was that we could operate in any weather,